Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to another session here of Booker T. Washington Speaks from the African Family Room, a forum. My name is Dr. Haleem Mustafa, Haleem the Dream Builder, Doctor of Self-Esteem, as your co-host. And the host and moderator is the Honorable Booker T. Washington great-grandson, Professor Marshall Cadmus Washington Obui. Tonight is a very exciting show we have around the idea of whether the vision of Dr. Martin Luther King is being fulfilled today. And that's not the topic specific, but just a general. So before we begin, I'd like to open in prayer in Arabic and English. I'll say it. Please, you can say it with me, and at least give me a vibration of comfort because I can feel your energy. Ayyudu billahi minashaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahir Rabbil Alamin. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. Maliki Yawmiddin. Iyyaka na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. Ihdina Siratal Mustaqim, Siratal Ladina Namta Alayhim, Ghayr wa Mahdubi Allahim, Walla Dalim, Ameen. In English translation, I seek refuge with Allah, away from the cursed devil Satan, with the name Allah, most gracious, most merciful. Praise be to Allah, cherisher and sustainer of the worlds, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. Thee do we worship, and thy aid do we seek. Show us a straight way, the way of those and those who thou hast bestowed thy grace. Portion is not wrath, and who go not astray. Amen. Let it be so. Now, Life Success Radio, Book to Watson speaks here from Ephraim. We have a topic tonight does the ethnic African American community still have the vision for its future that Dr. Martin Luther King had 50 years ago? That's a topic that we need to discuss to make an assessment of where we're at. So without any further ado, I'd like to ask the professor, please. Introduced you, sir. It's yours, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Haleem Mustafa, the Dream Builder, Dr. Self-Esteem. We send a thank you for being our co-host, co-moderator this evening, and just do a little radio check. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. Well, again, I just want to reiterate that topic because here we're living in a time like no time that I can remember in my lifetime, and I am 74 years old, and I was born during a time of great expectations by African Americans. I was born during World War II, when a lot of African Americans had left the farms and had gone into the urban areas hoping for good paying industrial jobs to get away from the slave plantation types of situations that many of them had been brought up on, and sharecropping situations and tenant farming situations. Many of them took advantage during the early 1900s to go up north, paid in the industrial building of America's cities because of the automobile factories that were being built and other industries that required labor. And a lot of the companies came south looking for able-bodied men to come up and do the heavy work, the work that the European immigrants did not want to do or to be on standby in case the European immigrants decided that they wanted to go on strike for better wages and better working conditions. Unfortunately, the depression of the 1930s caused a lot of pain for everyone, and especially for African Americans who started off at the bottom and never did get even two or three notches away from the bottom when the depression struck, and then it drove them back even farther than they had been. Life probably would have been a lot easier for many of them if they had stayed down south on the farms and plantations. But they managed to work together through a lot of mutual assistance, one neighbor looking out for the other neighbor. And they made it through until the beginning of the buildup for World War II. And because a lot of the young white men, either out of patriotism or because of the draft, were being taken out of the labor market, many more jobs were opened up in the industries, the war industries, the defense industries. And so black people began to have it better, even though in many cases they did jobs similar to what they had been doing in the past. But in other cases, they actually were able to rise up a few rungs on the ladder and do more technically skilled work. And things began to look up. In fact, the reason why I was born in Tuskegee, Alabama, rather than somewhere else, for example, like Atlanta, Georgia, my father had graduated from Morehouse College, and he had a lot of friends in Atlanta. In fact, he had his mentor who had set him up in the insurance business who lived in Atlanta, and he probably could have gone back to Atlanta to work, although his mentor wanted him to set up an insurance agency in Tuskegee. And that's the reason why he was in Tuskegee. But after the war broke out, he decided he wanted to become an Army officer. He wanted to become a pilot. And things were looking up for black people to have more opportunities. And the opportunity for my father to train as an Army pilot opened up, and he took advantage of it. And so he was commissioned as a lieutenant in the Army Air Force. And I was born there on the Tuskegee Army Airfield post where he had trained and been commissioned in the Army as an officer. So things started to look up. And then after the war, the returning veterans who had been able to enjoy a certain amount of freedom in Europe that they had never experienced in America, those who had come from the South anyway, they became a little bit more willing to agitate on behalf of more freedoms at home. And so the civil rights movement got started down south. And I remember in the mid-1950s, I remember the activist energy of the black community in Tuskegee. Without going into a lot of detail, that's where I met Dr. Martin Luther King. He had come down to Tuskegee after he had had a successful effort to desegregate the buses in Atlanta, in Montgomery. And he had come down to Tuskegee to respond to a call from the citizens of Tuskegee who had been gerrymandered which meant that the city limits had been redrawn to eliminate the black voters, the educated black voters, or potential black voters. And so we wanted somebody to come and encourage us to make it clear to us that we could achieve what had been achieved in Montgomery, that we could overturn this injustice. So we asked for Dr. King to come to Tuskegee, and that's when I met him. And there was a lot of hope. There was a lot of energy moving up into the 60s with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, March on Washington in 1963, the monumental speech that Dr. King gave, he outlined his vision. He said he looked forward to the time when Americans would be judged by the color, not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And then 5 years later, he was ruthlessly killed. And I was with him the last time in his hometown of Atlanta, Georgia. And it's ironic because he was an icon of black achievement, having graduated from prestigious Morehouse College and then gone to the Crozier Theological Seminary, having earned a master's degree in theology, and then gone ahead to Boston University, where he earned a doctorate degree. And there were very few people that came out to hear Dr. King speak that night at the Mount Moriah Baptist Church on West End Avenue, a few blocks, just two or three blocks down the street from the street that is now named after Martin Luther King. But Dr. King had begun to lose a lot of the popularity, even in Atlanta, that he had had in the past. And the reason was because there was a new spirit that was taking over, the spirit of accommodation, the spirit of nonviolence, the spirit of we'll push, but we won't push too hard. We will allow you to still push us around, hoping that our sacrifice of our dignity would allow your heart to be softened towards us. This was the essence of the Gandhian nonviolent philosophy that Dr. King practiced. Young people like H. Rap Brown, who now is in prison for something that had nothing to do with civil rights, but he's serving a life term in prison. I won't go into the details, but he's now known as Imam Al-Amin, but I still remember him as Rap Brown, because when he came to a setting where I was in 1968, the same year that Dr. King was killed, he was very, very, very militant, violent, burn, baby, burn. And the young people were more attracted to that than they were to the nonviolent preaching of Dr. King. And so when I sat there in this nearly empty church, which was the last speech that Dr. King gave in Atlanta, he said that he wasn't going to march anymore, and he never did. He said that though he wouldn't be around, he expected that the time was going to come, and it was going to come soon, when the world would be turned upside down. The racial situation would no longer have the black people on the bottom. A week later, the civil rights movement was turned upside down because we had lost the king. But the vision didn't stop. New forces became prominent. The Nation of Islam, which I joined in 1969, looking for a way to help bring about those changes that Dr. King had prophesied about, became stronger in the black community, but also in the urban communities, for example, out in the West Coast and even on the East Coast and in the Midwest, the Black Panther Party became very strong, and it attracted a lot of young black people and had the support of a lot of older black people, even some white people. And then the hopes became even greater because of black capitalism, which was a trick. We didn't know it then. But President Nixon, actually reflecting some of the thinking of Booker T. Washington, strangely enough, said we should basically pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, and instead of depending on the government to give us a lift to pick us up and carry us on its back, that we should build our own businesses, black capitalistic businesses. And that sounded so good, and there was money made available. Oh, yes. Back in those days, you didn't even have to have good credit. All you had to do was have a good game or a good sounding business proposal and walk into a bank dressed neatly, and you could walk out of there easily with $10,000 or $20,000 cash for the purpose of starting a black business. One of the problems with that was that many of our people did not understand that you cannot have a successful business with $20,000 cash unless you put all of that money into that business, which meant that you couldn't afford to quit your day job. You would have to work double hours keeping your day job to pay your bills, to take care of your family, and using that $20,000 as seed money to start building a customer base and buying equipment and so forth for your business. But we didn't know that because people that had no business training, but just realized that if you dressed up really nice and went in there and talked a smooth game about what you planned to do, the white people were going to give you that money. And maybe they thought that some of the black people would have had sense enough to know how to use it. But even a lot of our college-educated people that should have known better immediately went out, refurnished their houses with that money, bought at least new cars with that money, and even took their wives shopping to buy new clothes with that seed money that the white people had given them to start businesses. And just because they had a little storefront shop that might have had some nice furniture in there, they thought they had it made. But they didn't know anything about how to compete in the marketplace against these established businesses that weren't going to stop and give up their customers to these black business people. And before you know it, one by one, you saw these little black businesses close up the doors. And at the same time, you began to see these fine cars get repossessed because that money was not being replaced with new money that the business had earned, because the business really wasn't a real business. But we didn't know that. But our dream kept on. I lived it. It kept on. And then when Reaganomics came, we suffered, but we had learned how to manage. And we made it through Reaganomics. And then guess what? What I would call the boom years began. After the Bush 1 administration was over, which we made it through that, Desert Storm created some jobs, and we managed to get through that. But then the first black president, as he was called, but he wasn't really the first black president. Obama was. But Bill Clinton became the president, and oh boy, we really thought we were going to have it made then. Why? Because he went to our churches and blew his saxophone. And he could play. I guess he could play. I never heard him. But they say he did pretty well. At least he got our votes twice. But did he do anything for us? I don't know. I was in the U.S. military, and he didn't give us a raise. But his predecessor, Reagan, who everybody said hated black people, gave the military a big raise, and it made a lot of people join the military. What am I saying? I'm saying that we had a vision. At least we were still looking forward. At least we were still hoping that things were going to really get better. And as Stephanie said on our other show, we've done two shows this evening. This is the second show. We had a technical problem, so we had to shut down the first show. We're doing the first show, which had the same topic as we have tonight on this show. And she mentioned this, she sees all around us that things are getting better. Well, I see it. I'm living in a beautiful neighborhood. 90% of the occupants of this neighborhood are African Americans. I never saw people in my childhood living in the type of neighborhood that I'm living in here now. And the reason why a lot of these people are able to live in this kind of neighborhood is because of the jobs working for the U.S. government, or being in the military. Jobs that weren't available to black people in the military when my father was an officer, they are available today. I was earlier today in the presence of a number of gentlemen that are high-ranking officers in the military, black officers. As a matter of fact, I was sitting next to a very close friend of mine who told me he had just gotten notification within the last couple of days that he had been selected to go to the Army's War College. Now, the Army's War College is where they train up-and-coming generals. Now, he's a lieutenant colonel now, two steps away from being a general. And the fact that they are going to send him to this Army War College means they've already picked him. They've already picked him. It's like when you get one of these pre-approval notices for credit. That means they really already want you. If you can just make it through the credit check, they've already looked at your background, your income, and they feel that unless something comes up that's going to blow it for you, you'll be able to get that loan that they've offered you. Well, getting picked for the War College basically means they've already looked at you as being a potential general. That wasn't the case when I was a child. There were very, very few black generals. As a matter of fact, the only one that I ever heard they had was B.O. Davis Sr., and they only made him a general for political reasons to help President Roosevelt get the black vote up in the Northeast. Later, I knew a person by the name of Chappie James. You may have heard of him. He was one of the black aces during Korea. And he was a colonel longer than anybody else that had made colonel when he was promoted to colonel. And he told me personally, he said, they don't want to make me a general. This was around 1955, only 13 years after the famous Red Tails, the Tuskegee Airmen had proven their prowess and their fighting ability in Germany. But yet they still didn't want to make a black man a general. B.O. Davis Jr., he wasn't even a general at that time, I don't believe. But Chappie James said that for the people that got to be made colonels when he did, all of the rest of them that stayed in the Army were generals except for him. He said, they don't want to make me a general. But he said, but I'm not going to stay and not make general, and I'm not going to get out. They're not going to run me out, and I will make general. And he became the first four-star general of the African-American ethnicity in history. Because why? Because he persisted. So our topic today, for those who just joined us, and I see a number of people have just joined us, is does the ethnic African-American community still have the vision for its community life, and even their personal lives that Dr. Martin Luther King had 50 years ago? Because we're coming up on, I won't call it celebrating, I'll call it a remembrance of the end of the earthly mission of Dr. Martin Luther King in April, on the 4th of April, coming up in about 4 months. We'll be recognizing the end of the physical life of Dr. Martin Luther King. And just before he spoke at Memphis, as I was saying, for those of you who just joined, I heard him personally speak in Atlanta about a week before, and he said that he wasn't marching anymore because he said his time for that was over. But he said there was coming a time when the world was going to be turned upside down, and that which was on the bottom was going to come up to the top. And he envisioned our people rising up. Now, earlier on the early broadcast, Stephanie had mentioned she sees that change coming, and it's very slow, but she says we should still have hope in the future because some things take time. Well, I'm going to ask you all to come on in and chime in. Do you think that our people collectively still have the vision of the progress that Dr. Martin Luther King had spoken about in his dream and also later when he said that the bottom was going to rise to the top? Or when he said the night before he was killed that I've been to the mountaintop, and I have seen the promise of the Lord. He said, I won't get there with you, but I know as a people we will get there to the promised land. Do you think our people still have that vision? So I've opened up everybody's mic, and you know our rule is first come, first serve. So anyone that wants to chime in, you go right ahead, and everybody else, we will listen. Please go ahead.
Well, this is Helene the Dream Builder, Dr. Self-Seen. I just want to say no, emphatically, an emphatic no. And I'll give just a little summary, just is that a lot of times people who are psychologists in terms of managing societies, they know how to assuage or make people feel that they are in a leadership or progressive role. And they do these commercials on TV just to give that impression. And the reality, as you look under what is the, let me say, like the Wizard of Oz, you remember the Wizard of Oz where he was in the box making all this noise, and Dorothy, she was really scared, the Scarecrow was scared, and the Iron Man was scared, and little the little dog Toto went and found the curtain, and Dorothy then opened the curtain, and there the wizard was making all this noise and acting like he was like doing some things profoundly. Same thing here that we're talking in America. There's a lot of this behavior of utilizing a strategy to psychologically keep black people in place. Now, I won't go further on that point, but I just want to say that as my first comment.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Mustafa. Well, everybody's mic is open, so you can just come on in and just let us know what's on your mind. First come, first serve.
Hi. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening, this is Biden.
Go ahead.
No,
you
say that again. This is Biden,
okay.
Say that again.
I thought someone else was speaking before me, but I just wanted to say that no, I don't think we are. Maybe some of us are on the road because of psychological warfare programs that have targeted the black community and social engineers that, you know, control and create programs and ring bells in the schools, have people changing classes based on periods, which has something to do with a woman's menstrual cycle. There's a whole lot of stuff going on that people are not aware of, subliminal suggestions in our community, putting stories out there about people wearing saggy pants down below their butt because of what was going on in the prison. That's just a bunch of lies. We're being socially engineered. There's psychological warfare working against. There's all kind of programs going on out here working against our community. So, no, we haven't gotten there. No, we're not there. Maybe a few of us, but not enough. So my answer is no.
Okay, let me just say this, and I hear what you're saying, but now we weren't there then by any stretch of the imagination, at least in my opinion, in 1963, when Dr. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. I mean, there was still rigorous, rigid segregation still in my home state of Alabama, still being murdered on the streets by vigilantes and even white, what I call highway killers. But we had a dream. We had a vision of what I'm asking is, do we as a community still have that dream? Do we still have that vision? We know things have improved somewhat, as Stephanie said earlier, but notwithstanding the fact that we haven't gotten there yet, we are at the mountaintop yet, but do we still have a getting there? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I guess I need to be, there's so much, there aren't too many people who are thinking people today. Let me put it that way. We're being bombarded with so much stuff that I don't think people can even think about the dream that Martin Luther King had. And they don't want people to think. That's why we're going through a dumbing down the dumbing down of America, the dumbing down of people in school system, in the school system. It's a covert, negative social engineering, psychological warfare program out here working against us. So even if I don't even think the people can think the internet, your mind is being bombarded constantly. They don't want people to think. So even if we have arrived there, I don't think people can even think about, did we get there yet? Because there's so much other stuff going on that they don't want people to think. And we're in a state of topsy-turvy now. I think we're in Armageddon or at the beginning of Armageddon, and that's why all this other stuff is going on all over this world. I think there's so much hidden language that people, the biblical language is hidden language. Is okay, for example, and Peter said something about in the Bible it says that Peter was crucified upside down. That's symbolic language that the fitra, the natural nature of human beings, has been turned upside down, and we're in the 21st century, and we have all the stuff going on, transgender sex, people don't know what sex they are. There's just so much stuff going on that I don't think people can even think about the dream that Martin Luther King had for us because of all this other craziness that's going on around us and this psychological social engineering warfare programs that they have unleashed on the black community, which they have never stopped, but they're even worse now. So I don't think people know what to think anymore. Or even if there are very few many thinking people out here because their minds are being bombarded with so much technology and artificial intelligence, and we all have our little robots now. We all have a cell phone. We're all being tracked. Our minds are bombarded daily. So I don't even know how. There are very few people who think, because people are watching TV, they're looking at the news constantly, they're listening to the radio. How many people just sit down somewhere quietly and even think about what somebody wrote? How many people even sit down and really read a book? Not too many people even read anymore. I don't think so. I would think that we're very few people are in a position or are even capable of even thinking about Martin Luther King. And if you probably ask some of these young people, they'll probably tell you that the Civil Rights Movement was something that somebody made up. That's how dumbed down America is today. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks, Sister Vanna. Well, we
like
have
to
a number. Oh,
I
yeah, please go right ahead.
Respond to that.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Hi, my name's Judy. Yeah, so this is an interesting conversation, and I definitely like what the sister just said, as well as Dr. Mustafa. My comment is this: it's interesting. I think you're so right, sister. Thinking is obsolete. That's part of the game plan. Is that we're not thinking. They're trying to occupy our time so that we have no time to think. But going back to your question about Martin Luther King and the dream, I feel as if, you know, there are so many weapons of mass destruction that are aimed at us mentally, and it's just like a marketing plan. If you think about television, which is tell a vision, you know, everything is marketed to us out. We're not a unified people anymore. That's one of the first things. Everything is very divisive. if you look at the different generations, they have broken us apart divisively by the different generations, Generation X, the millennials, the baby boomers. Everybody is being programmed something different. And the thing is, I find it interesting that people who are the baby boomers, we're the ones that have the most passion and understanding and realization of the struggle and the Black Power movement and unity in the community and the power of coming together. So many of this generation is passing on and is making their transition. We dropped the ball, in my opinion, in really keeping the revolution and the struggle alive. We never, you know, we did not pass that on in the manner that we have. And just like the sister said, so many young people, I have a daughter, she's 23, you know, they don't have any real, they don't really relate to the civil rights movement. That's where we really dropped the ball. We just, you know, this assimilation into society that we just merged in into the mainstream middle class America, capitalism. You know, that's what's being programmed to our kids now. We program that to our children ourselves, the baby boomers, and, you know, helping them just get yourself together in the 80s. You know, we have lost the dream. The dream, this is a last, I don't want to go on too long because everybody wants to participate in the conversation. I just wanted to add that I've been watching various shows. There's a show that comes on now called Sister Circle, and the women on there, you know, it's a very positive, uplifting talk show similar to The View, and it airs. And these women are very positive. They're bringing on women. They're basically women that are, I guess, in their 40s, late 30s. They're bringing on a lot of women who are entrepreneurs, and I think this generation, the 30s, the 40s, the 20s, I think they have a lot of hope. They're interested in doing business. They want to start their businesses. You know, everybody, I think they're on an upbeat. It's like they're not really seeing what's going on behind the scenes. They're caught up into this illusion, you know. They're all looking at success, but I don't think very many of the generations other than the baby boomers have any real idea of what's going on. I think we're in a panic because we see what's going on. All right, that's all I'm going to say for now. I'm sorry it took so long.
Okay,
I apologize.
Thank you, Judy.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, well,
hello?
Anyone else? Go ahead, please.
Yes. Okay, this is Stephanie Benson Runnels again, your dear sister-in-law. And I'm just going to say straight out, I think a lot of the callers tonight, I'm saying this respectfully, see the glass as half empty. And me, myself, I see the glass as half full. I also think it is a slap in the face to all the successful Black people in this United States, because we have come a long way. There was a time you were not seeing Black pilots, colleges filled with Black students, Black teachers and professors, Black lawyers and judges and Black people owning homes and businesses. We are on the uprise. The statistics say that the majority of graduating college students nowadays are Black females. Give them some sort of props. Give these people their props. There was a time where we couldn't even sit on a bus, and now look at us. We're able to freely speak on how and what's going on without the KKK coming and burning our house down. I thank God, and I do see a change. I'm not saying we have made it, but we have come a long way. And we need to be a little bit more positive. I see enough where I can say I see the glass half full and not half empty. I'm not going to slap anybody in the face by saying we haven't gotten anywhere, because you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of a pimp prostitute goes out and does all she can and brings him all she can, and then that pimp slaps the money out of her hand, beats her up, and says, that ain't nothing. She did all she could for it. I'm proud of my granddaughter and several others like her who is in college to be a scientific pathologist, scientific forensic pathologist. Proud of that girl. We only have 5 in the country. We have a black girl getting ready to marry the prince over there in England, royalty. We have white people standing up for our rights, fighting in the streets for us. And like I said, every time, 9 times out of 10, when I hear a commercial on television, it's black music in the background. Come on. Earlier I had read out of Proverbs 1:29-30, for they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Therefore shall they eat the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. We're not going to get through to everybody out there. There's always going to be some people that's hard-headed, coming from a tore-up family. But it boils down to those who reject the truth which God reveals to us and choose to walk in their own way are in danger of being able to walk their own path in life. You know, so it's more like what we put in is what we're going to get out. Okay. Well, thank you all.
Okay.
Stephanie, can I say something?
Yeah.
I think that... I think you might misunderstand my thinking. When Martin Luther King was here, he was a very spiritual person. You couldn't buy him, okay? These people today, they have chosen materialism as their God, okay? These people worship materialism. I think that we place too much emphasis, and this is social engineering. It goes back to social engineering. They have engineered people away from the creator. The creator to these people now is materialism, okay? That's their God. That's what their God is materialism. So, no, I don't think we still haven't, no. Martin Luther King's done on spirituality. It wasn't based on materialism. So, yes, we may have achieved money and wealth and power, but we don't have unity because we don't have that spirituality that's what's missing in our community. We don't have that unity that united the people. They were spiritual people. The slaves were spiritual people. The people from the civil rights movement were spiritual people. They were not materialists. Today, we live in a world of materialism. We live in artificial intelligence. We live in artificial humanism. These people would rather communicate with their cell phone in a doctor's office than have a conversation with a real human being. We're in a totally different mindset, and it's all because of social engineering in our community. And not only the black community, the whole entire society, you know? It's not a black or white thing anymore. It's about people using psychological warfare and programming to engineer society towards materialism. Everybody wants a dollar. It's all about money. That's why they elected somebody like Donald Trump to be president. They don't care about – he's up there telling people, using racism, bringing the KKK back out. Okay? White supremacy, white privilege. Black, people want to be – want black privilege. So then these social engineers are sitting back laughing at society, laughing at the black people, laughing at the white men. They're having fun and lining their pockets with money, because that's what this world is all about now. There's no spiritualism. There's people. You can't even go to church now because somebody may have been psychologically programmed to come up in there and kill everybody. You can't go to work because somebody may have been psychologically programmed to come into school and kill everybody. You can't, where can you go? You can't even get on the bus. You can't stand at the bus stop. Somebody may be, no, we're in a totally different, no, we have not gotten there because we lost our spirituality. That's what I'm, and we're still being psychologically programmed through these, by these social engineers. And people don't even think about, oh, is there a social engineer? What's that? They don't even know what that is. They probably don't even know who the vice president is because they don't know how to think. They're not teaching people how to think in school anymore. They're giving them their little personal robot, their cell phone, and if you take it away from them, they will have a heart attack. Or they may attack you and kill you because you got their phone. Their little robot. No, we lost our spirituality. No, we're not there. No, the dream for everybody. I don't care who they are. We're in a battle. Armageddon, they're having parties right now. Armageddon parties. They're having Armageddon parties. The beginning of Armageddon parties people are having right now. That's how sick our society is because we have become materialists. They turned God into a stone. They want to bring God down here on a level where we are. He's so large, but they can't even think. They don't even know that the supreme being is a supreme being. He's a creator. He's outside of all of, he's outside of the matrix. It's his matrix. But they won't even give him ownership of the matrix, of the universe, of nothing. It's all about a dollar. It's all about the golden calf. That's where we are today. We lost our spirituality. And until we get that back, we're doomed. I finished.
Okay,
I want to play a little short piece just to kind of change the mood a little bit because I want to bring on something when I come back, which is the actual words of Martin Luther King, because our topic really was, does the ethnic African-American community today still have the vision for community life, for the life of our ethnic community, the African-American community that Martin Luther King had? So we need to reacquaint ourselves in order to have this discussion be on the track that the topic actually calls for. We need to bring ourselves back to Martin Luther King. So just relax for a minute, and we're going to just play something for less than 2 minutes. And we're going to come with Martin Luther King's actual speech. We won't necessarily give it all to you, but enough so you understand what his vision was. These are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King
spoken about 50 years ago in August of 1967, just a few months before he was killed, spoken in his hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, on the 16th of August, 1967. Martin Luther King said that when his organization called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was formed 10 years ago, racial segregation was still a structured part of the architecture of Southern society. Negroes, with the pangs of hunger and the anguish of thirst, were denied access to the average lunch counter. The downtown restaurants were still off limits for the black man and black woman. Negroes burdened with the fatigue of travel were still barred from the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. Negro boys and girls in dire need of recreational activities were not allowed to inhale the fresh air of the big city parks. Negroes in desperate need of allowing their mental buckets to sink deep into the wells of knowledge were confronted with a firm no when they sought to use the city libraries. 10 years ago, legislative halls of the South were still ringing loud with such words as interposition and nullification. And for those of you that don't know what it means is that the South took a position that they could nullify any federal law that benefited black people that they did not like. He continues, all types of conniving methods were still being used to keep the Negro from becoming a registered voter. A decade ago, not a single Negro entered the legislative chambers of the South except as a porter or a chauffeur. 10 years ago, all too many Negroes were still harried by day and haunted by night by a corroding sense of fear, a nagging sense of nobodiness. But things are different now. In assault after assault, we caused the sagging walls of segregation to come tumbling down. And during this era, the entire edifice of segregation was profoundly shaken. This is an accomplishment whose consequences are deeply felt by every Southern Negro in his or her daily life. It is no longer possible to count the number of public establishments that are open to Negroes. 10 years ago, Negroes seemed invisible to the larger society, and the facts of their harsh lives were unknown to the majority of the nation. But today, civil rights is a dominating issue in every state, crowding the pages of the press and the daily conversation of white Americans. In this decade of change, the Negro stood up and confronted his oppressor. He faced the bullies and the guns, the dogs and the tear gas. He put himself squarely before the vicious mobs and moved with strength and dignity toward them and decisively defeated them. And the courage with which he confronted enraged mobs dissolved the stereotype of the grinning, submissive Uncle Tom. He came out of his struggle integrated only slightly in the external society, but powerfully integrated within. This was a victory that had to precede all other gains. In short, over the last 10 years, the Negro decided to straighten his back up and her back up, realizing that a man or a woman cannot ride your back unless it is bent. We made our government write new laws to alter some of the cruelest injustices that affected us. We made an indifferent and unconcerned nation rise from lethargy and subpoenaed its conscience to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. We gain manhood in the nation and womanhood in the nation that had always called us boy or called us girl or gal, as you might have heard in the South in the old days. It would have been hypocritical indeed if I allowed modesty forbid my saying that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference stood at the forefront of all of the watershed movements that brought these monumental changes in the South. For this, we can feel a legitimate pride, but in spite of a decade of significant progress, the problem is far from solved. The deep rumbling of discontent in our cities is indicative of the fact that the plant of freedom has grown only a bud and not yet a flower. Before discussing the awesome responsibilities that we face in the days ahead, let us take an inventory of our programmatic action and activities over the past year. Last year, as we met in Jackson, Mississippi, we were painfully aware of the struggle of our brothers in Grenada, Mississippi. After living for 100 or more years under the yoke of total segregation, the Negro citizens of this northern Delta hamlet banded together in nonviolent warfare against racial discrimination under the leadership of our affiliate chapter and organization there. The fact of this non-destructive rebellion was as spectacular as its results. In a few short weeks, the Grenada County movement challenged every aspect of the society's exploitative life. Stores which denied employment were boycotted. Voter registration increased by thousands. We can never forget the courageous action of the people of Grenada, who moved our nation and its federal courts to powerful action in behalf of school integration, giving Grenada one of the most integrated school systems in America. The battle is far from over, but the black people of Grenada have achieved 40 of 53 demands through their persistent nonviolent efforts. And then I'll move fast forward to what he says on a national level that's missing. He says, speaking of Chicago, the most dramatic success in Chicago has been Operation Breadbasket. Through Operation Breadbasket, we have now achieved for the Negro community of Chicago more than 2,200 new jobs with an income of approximately $18 million a year, new income to the Negro community. But not only have we gotten jobs through Operation Breadbasket in Chicago, there was another area through this economic program, and that was the development of financial institutions which were controlled by Negroes and which were sensitive to problems of economic deprivation of the Negro community. The two banks in Chicago that were interested in helping Negro businessmen were largely unable to loan much because of limited assets. Hilo, one of the chain stores in Chicago, agreed to maintain substantial accounts in the two banks, thus increasing their ability to serve the needs of the Negro community. And I can say to you today that as a result of Operation Breadbasket in Chicago, both of these Negro-operated banks have now more than doubled their assets, and this has been done in less than a year by the work of Operation Breadbasket. And I'm going to fast forward again, and we'll talk now about what he says still needs to be done. With all the struggle and all the achievements, we must face the fact, however, that the Negro still lives in the basement of the great society. He is still at the bottom, despite the few who have penetrated to the highly or slightly higher levels. Even when the door has been forced partially open, mobility for the Negro is still sharply restricted. There's often no bottom at which to start, and where there is, there's almost no room at the top. In consequence, Negroes are still impoverished aliens in an affluent society. They are too poor even to rise with the society, and too impoverished by the ages to be able to ascend by using their own resources. And the Negro did not do this himself. It was done to him. For more than half of his American history, he was enslaved. And yet he built the spanning bridges, the grand mansions, the sturdy docks, and stout factories of the South. His unpaid labor made cotton king and established America as a significant nation in international commerce. Even after his release from chattel slavery, the nation grew over him, submerging him. It became the richest, most powerful society in the history of man, but it left the Negro behind, far, far behind. And so we still have a long, long way to go before we reach the promised land of freedom. Yes, we have left the dusty soils of Egypt, and we have crossed the Red Sea that had for years been hardened by a long and piercing winter of massive resistance. But before we reach the majestic shores of the promised land, there will still be gigantic mountains of opposition ahead and prodigious hilltops of injustice. We still need some Paul Revere of conscience to alert every hamlet and every village of America that revolution is still at hand. Yes, we need a chart. We need a compass. Indeed, we need some North Star to guide us into a future shrouded with impenetrable uncertainties. Now, in order to answer the question, where do we go from here? Which is our theme, we must first honestly recognize where we are now. When the Constitution was written, a strange formula to determine taxes and representation declared that the Negro was 60% of a person. Today, another curious formula seems to declare he is 50% of a person. Of the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad things of life, he has twice those of whites. And thus half of all Negroes live in substandard housing. And Negroes have half the income of whites. And when we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The rate of infant mortality among Negroes is double that of whites. And there are twice as many Negroes dying in overseas wars as whites in proportion to their size in the population. Where do we go from here? First, we must massively assert our dignity and our worth. We must stand up amid a system that still oppresses us and develop an unassailable and majestic sense of values. We must no longer be ashamed of being black. The job of arousing manhood within a people that have been taught for so many centuries that they are nobody is not easy. And then we'll fast forward again, and we'll be finished in just a minute. He says that Ossie Davis, the great former black spokesman, playwright, and stage actor, movie actor, the husband of Ruby Dee, has suggested that maybe the English language should be reconstructed so that teachers will not be forced to teach the Negro child 60 ways to despise himself and herself and thereby perpetuate his or her false sense of inferiority, and teach the white child 134 ways to adore himself or herself and thereby perpetuate his false sense of superiority. The tendency to ignore the Negro's contributions to American life and strip him and her of his or her
personhood is as old as the earliest history books and as contemporary as the morning newspaper. And we're going to close with this note. The speech goes on and on, but I'm not going to read it all. I'll just close with this. Now, we must develop progress, or rather, a program that will drive the nation to a guaranteed annual income. Now, early in this century, this proposal would have been greeted with ridicule and denunciation as destructive of initiative and responsibility. At that time, economic status was considered the measure of an individual's abilities and talents. And in the thinking of that day, the absence of worldly goods indicated a want of industrious habits and moral fiber. But we have come a long way in our understanding of human motivation and of the blind operation of our economic system. Now, we realize that dislocations in the market operation of our economy and the prevalence of discrimination thrust people into idleness and bind them in constant or frequent unemployment against their will. The poor are less often dismissed, I hope, from our conscience today as being branded as inferior or incompetent. And we also know that no matter how dynamically the economy develops and expands, it does not eliminate all poverty. And so I'll close by giving this comment, and then I'll let the mics be open to everyone to contribute your feelings and thoughts. But Martin Luther King, when this speech had concluded, he offered courage and he offered hope that among ourselves we would regain that sense of wanting to break down those barriers that had been unjustly erected to hold us back. And we would remove whatever barriers we constructed within our own psyche to keep us from trying to break down barriers that had been erected to hold us back. And I agree that many of our people have given up on the vision, or maybe they never even were taught about it, because maybe they don't know anything about the struggles that the civil rights workers endured, the freedom marches endured. Maybe they don't know anything about the many attempts at black business development that were started up in the black power days of the 70s. And maybe now all they can think of is trying to get out on the street and make some fast money, or go to college and get in a situation where they can get a good paycheck. But the vision is bigger than all that. And in my opinion, and this is just me speaking, the vision should be the same vision that Booker T. Washington proposed over 150 years ago. Booker T. Washington said that we should cast down our buckets where we are and take advantage of all of the opportunities that are right at our feet and make ourselves the best in whatever we are able to do. He said that even if our job was as menial as shining shoes, we should try to get the reputation for being the best shoe shiner in the city. If we are working in a bank, we should try to get the reputation for being the best cashier or bank worker in the bank. If we are a medical doctor, we should try to get the reputation for being the best medical doctor in the hospital. Whatever we do, whether it's being a school teacher, a business person, we should try to set the standard and have people looking up to us, as George Washington Carver did, who set the standard in the field of science of agriculture. And if we do that, Booker T. Washington said that the world will come to our front door begging us to participate when they sit down at the table to discuss the future of the society. So that's my little talk for this evening, and we will go ahead and open up everybody's mic. Subject for those of you who may have just joined us is the question, does the African American, the ethnic African American communities today still have the vision for community progress that Martin Luther King had 50 years ago. And I'm opening the mics now, so this will take just a second.
Professor, I want to thank you very much. This is Haleem the Dream Builder, Doctor of Self-Esteem. I want to say that that speech is relevant today more than ever. And I just say this as a biblical reference, know ye the truth, and the truth shall set you free. This is a problem. We are not knowing the truth, and therefore we are being erased in the mental past, where the mental understanding is being erased through what is today a show of you know, change. It's only a mirage, as I see it. Until we ourselves are building these skyscrapers, until we ourselves are building the roads and freeways, until we ourselves are in leadership in a way that distinguishes us as making a stamp on this society. Like, for example, I tell you, the Chinese people, they have such a internal structure that they are kind of almost invisible in this country. But if you go to Chinatown, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. They have economic independence and are contributing tax dollars to this country. So we need that same kind of structure, and this is a position that we are kind of avoiding, and the church community need to become more active outside of the church buildings and go to the streets to help the reality of transforming the image of the community and the attitudes of the people. That's my comments for now.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I want to speak about a writer named Ian Cummings. He wrote an article back in 2013, and he addressed the war on drugs, Ronald Reagan, the drug gulag, and he talked about how in 30 years how the U.S. prison population increased from 300,000 to more than 2 million because of the war on drugs. And he talked about the rate of the prison rate, the rate of the imprisonment, how America imprisons more people nationally than any country in the world, and how our community is blighted by prison records. And he talks about the scars of the history of racism and segregation. You can see that even when Barack Obama was elected president. He talked about how deep these segregation he gave an example of George Zimmerman. How we're still being racially profiled, and how six times more black people go to jail in this country. Six times more black people than white people go to jail. He talked about the crippling of segregation and the chains of discrimination and the poverty that we're still in, despite the fact that we live in a country that's so, it's an ocean of materialism. He talked about social justice and the political injustice and how there's so much racial tension even today. Look at the racial tension. Even Stephanie brought it up, talking about the KKK trying to come out, the right-wing people. Michelle Alexander, she wrote that book talking about mass imprisonment, the new Jim Crow. And she talked about in 1850, today, we have more people in prison than they had as slaves in 1850. So how is the dream? Where is it? Yes, we may have hopes for freedom,
But with all this stuff still going on, it's all about materialism. And it still goes back to what I was saying earlier. There are social engineers out here. If Reagan didn't come up with the war on drugs, which the drug gulag is getting bigger, the drug gulag, that's it. The war on drugs, the Ronald Reagan war, the drug gulag. Even if you let all the people out of prison, they got another system set up so that when you get out, you're still going to be blighted by your prison record. You can't get an apartment because you've been to prison. You can't get a job because you've been to prison. You can't vote because you've been to prison. So you got a felony. So, they got social engineers, they got another plan for you. If you get out from under that one, they got another one waiting for you. So where's the dream for freedom? They brought us here to be permanent slaves. The prison system, the jails and all that, that's a money-making business. They use us to make money off of us. And then they put us out there to clean the roads and the streets and the sidewalks and all this other stuff. Free labor, pretty much. They got all this wealth in the 1800s for free. And they got all this wealth piled up right now. Social engineering has been going on for a long time. So that's all I have to say about that.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut the mics back on because I've turned the mics off and people are talking just to make sure there's no background noise. So just give me 1 second and everybody will be able to have access to the airwaves. So please bear with me for just a second and you'll all be able to speak. Okay. Just 1 second. Everybody's mic is turned on from the studio, so please go ahead and chime right on in. We have about 12 minutes left. I'm going to spend the last 2 minutes with a commercial for my book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. So we have actually maybe about 10 minutes, which is enough time to have some serious, good, continuing conversation. So please chime in if you have something you'd like to share.
Yes. I would like to.
I would like to make a comment.
Stephanie, let Judy speak. She didn't speak too much. She spoke a lot.
That's fine. Thank you.
Come on in for a minute. Judy, go ahead.
My phone actually died right after I made my last comment. But I wanted to say this: the dream has been deferred. I mean, the dream, the whole vision, the dream has changed. In my opinion, you know, we live we're under a white supremacist system, and as African Americans, Africans, whatever we are, targeted for genocide. And again, I always talk about these weapons of mass destruction, which go from mass incarceration to the food to our dumbed down education, miseducation, killing, targeting, killing our youth and drugs in the community. There's so many weapons of destruction, but the thing is that knowledge is power. We don't know who we are. I think as far as the dream goes, I know one of the sisters mentioned all the opportunities we've had, and I think on another call there was a mention of segregation, how far we've come. Well, we have a lot more opportunities today, I think. The opportunities are there, the technology, there's access on the internet to all kind of information. But what really puts us so far away in my mind from the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King, one of them is our consciousness. We don't have the consciousness that matches the opportunities that we have. We could do so many things to come back into power with the opportunities that exist if we had a consciousness to empower our people and to work as a unit, as a group, and understand the importance of power in numbers, and that unity in the community is what brought us power. That's how we gained black power. And in the 70s and following the 60s, we demonstrated it in the 60s, and then we benefited from it in the 70s. And by the 80s, there was a realization from the system that the way that they would, and this is where I kind of see our fall with the dream of Martin Luther King. You know, we fought to be able to integrate and spend our money and be, you know, go into the mass system spending money economically and going in places, but we didn't have the consciousness. We took all of our money out of our own communities. We started building other people's empires, and as a result, they were able to dissolve all of our power by allowing integration, because if we had stayed segregated, we would have been following the Booker T. Washington model of self, you know, putting our buckets, laying our buckets down where we are and building trade and skills that we already had from slavery and empowering our own communities. We would have been able to be self-sufficient. And as a group, we're a group-oriented society. No matter how much we talk about it's not black, it's not white, it really is. We still, the Chinese have their Chinatown, the Hispanics, every group comes together and they have, they execute and demonstrate economic power by coming together. So that's where we're fought, we're failing. We're not unified. We have the opportunities, but we do not have the consciousness to back up. So that's kind of the main thing that I wanted to say. We're oppressed. We're an oppressed people, and what we did is we integrated into a white supremacist system, and we're funding our own oppression. We're working and we're doing all these things, but we're not using our money wisely, and we're not empowering ourselves. We're not self-sufficient. We're slaves. We're still slaves. That's what I want to say.
Thank you.
Okay, I think Stephanie, you were wanting to say something, and I asked you to hold up and let Judy speak. Would you like to come on now?
Yes, thank you very much. This is Stephanie Benson Runnels again. And please, I don't want anyone to misconstrue what I said before, because I never said we have made it. We're not even close to making it. But what I did say is we have come a long way. And just listening to Dr. Martin Luther King, you know we have come a long way. There is no doubt from there to here. My grandmother had that album with all of Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches, and I used to listen to that. And that is another reason why I know we have come a long way. Yes, we do still have a long way to go, but no one has shackles on my feet. No, I will not apologize to anyone for living comfortably, because that is what God has blessed me to do. No, I will not stop going to church because some fool shot up shooting people in public, because the devil has always roamed the earth and he always will. But I serve a real God. We serve a real God. And we're going to keep on serving them. We're not going to say, oh, I give up on that. I'm not going there because of the devil. No, God is most powerful. Don't ever forget that. Once again, from Dr. Martin Luther King, I think that we are still in our struggle, still trying to conform to what he talked about. And I think it might be slowly, but I think we're getting there. I see a lot of progress. And if we occupy so much of our brain with the negativity and what we don't have and the horrible things that's going on, we leave no room in our brain to see what is going on and the positive aspects. How can we then lift up our young people if we're not encouraging them with something a little more positive? And once again, I give two thumbs up to everyone who has worked towards this struggle and who is encouraging on being someone, encouraging someone else on being something wonderful. I believe that all of our speakers are wonderful people who has gotten somewhere in this struggle, and give yourself a pat on the back. I know we're not where we want to be, and we're not even where we should be. But we are making progress. Know that. Thank you. I love you all. God bless you all. Good night.
Good night. Good night, Stephanie. And as we get ready to close, we want to play some inspired music. But I thought
the
I heard.
The shackles are not on our ankles. The shackles are not on our ankles. The shackles are on our minds. And the progress.
Take it off.
And I appreciate the positive things that you said, sister. Yeah, you said some positive things, but I mean, really, that I find it fascinating, but it's just a point of view difference, how you see how we progress materially, but as a people, I see us going backwards, and I see them quickly turning back the hands of time on in so many areas, from education to the laws and everything. So I do find it interesting for you to say we're progressing every day.
Okay. Well, we're going to close with that comment. As we close, we want you to hear this and think about the way we felt 50 years ago, and we should still feel that we cannot be moved.
We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved.
Well, we've reached the end of our time for this week. We hope that you all will join us again next week. We began at 8 o'clock this evening, and we had a little technical glitch, so we had to start back again a few minutes after 9. But we will continue to broadcast at 8 p.m. until 10. So join us again, those who are listening, at 8 o'clock next Saturday evening for another enlightening, mean, and inspiring discussion on Booker T. Washington, an African-American family forum on FROM Radio. This is Marshall Washington, Cabinet Abui, the senior great of the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, your host and moderator, along with our co-host and co-moderator, Alim Mustafa. And he has already announced his number for his show. We just have a few minutes left, so I want you all to know how you can hear his show on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. So, Dr. Mustafa, I want to give the mic to you. We just have a few seconds left, so you can tell our audience how they can tune in to Life Success Radio.
Yes, I'll say quickly. Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. I want to say quickly, the call-in number is 929-477-3556. That's 929-477-3556. That's for you to call in to Life Success Radio. And we do right now the schedules Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday will continue. And we certainly are solution-driven. I want to say to everyone tonight, it's been a very powerful discussion, and I've just been taking a lot of notes and hearing the intelligence that we have. And this is what I want to say, is that we have right now, we're compromising ourselves. So let me just say like this. Say, freedom like justice is a compromise. Freedom like justice is a compromise. We got to ask ourselves, are we compromising for freedom, right? And justice is something that we're not receiving. So the question, we have to be a little more aggressive about our own survival and prosperity, and that's my last comments.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank everyone for joining us tonight. We're going to end with what is known as the Black National Anthem, something that we hope will inspire us this day.
Well, now we shall not be moved. Oh, we.
Lift every voice and sing. Lift every voice and sing. Here's the music.